Broadcaster and former Liberal MP Sir Clement Freud. The service took place at a church just off Fleet Street in central London. That's the latest. I'm Dave Terris.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225. Or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Hello and welcome. This is BCFM's Friday Drive Time, aka The Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and coming up in the next hour, my guests and I will be looking at Bristol's preparedness for emergencies, whether natural or man-made. Civil defence went out of fashion at the end of the Cold War, and since 2000, we've had something called civil resilience. But how is it different? And are Bristol's public servants up to the job? We hear from the top man at Bristol City Council, as well as critical view from someone trained as part of the old civil defence system. The budget. Economics correspondent Martin Summers is here to give a community perspective on No. 11 Downing Street's prescription for the sick patient, our economy. Our reporter Quentin Marceron has been out on the streets asking Bristolians whether you think the city is likely to be the target of a terrorist attack. And to wrap up the show, Colin Powers here to tell us about his attempts as a layman to navigate his way through Britain's legal system. So, coming up in a minute, our community budget report. But before that, here's the long-range forecast for the next two weekends from, that's right, you heard me right, the next two weekends from metcheck.com. This weekend, it'll be reaching a mild 12 degrees Celsius in the afternoons. It'll be rain tomorrow, moving mostly clearing up afterwards. There'll be sunny periods over the rest of the weekend. creeping up temperatures towards the end of next week and sunny periods through the week. Next weekend, that's the 2nd and 3rd of May, they'll be getting warmer, about 15 to 16 degrees Celsius. There's also sunny periods again next weekend and light winds. Week after next, it goes up to a much warmer 18 degrees Celsius. And Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, the week after next, a lot more sun. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. Anyway, it's budget week, where number 11 Downing Street calls the shots. And our economics correspondent, late of Bristol Debt Advice Centre, Martin Summers, is now joining me to discuss it. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Can you tell us, Chancellor Alistair Darling's got an almost universal bad press this week, particularly about the mounting debt. Do you think that's justified?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's very difficult to get a good press when the economy is in such a mess. And, of course, the debt issue is fundamental. But, of course, whoever was standing there would face pretty much the same problem, because the problems are not Alistair Darling, the problem is the economy.
OK, I mean, what do you think? There's anything... there's a bit of a sort of paradox going on here, isn't there? Because the government have to spend to get out of the slump, but if they do, they're going beyond the acceptable limits to public borrowing.
The reason they're going beyond the acceptable limits for public borrowing is because all the money that's been thrown at the banks in the last 12 months, which has completely destroyed the original budget plans. That is the source of the problem. And there's not a lot. I mean, at this stage of the game, it's very hard to see how they can possibly control the debt situation because of the money that's been poured down the endless throat of the banks.
OK, so do you see anything positive in the budget?
Well, I'm bound to say this, but the 50% top tax rate should have been done years ago. They're even apologetic about it and saying, oh my goodness, we don't really mean to be doing this. But of course, if you think about it, the wealthy people in this country, they've made an awful lot of money out of this boom. Who else is going to pay for the bust except them? And at least a step has been taken in that direction.
So, anyway, do you think there's some sort of political motive behind the whole sort of financial crash? Because it doesn't seem it's totally devoid of politics. The banks obviously have got political interests as well.
What happened was that the banks were so politically powerful that they were able, partly, of course, in the US and elsewhere, because they bankroll the political process, that they were able to persuade the politicians to let them do whatever they wanted. And that's why we got into the mess. And so in that sense, there is a political problem here, which is that the politicians have allowed the banks to do what they wanted, and they shouldn't have allowed that to happen.
Well, that's all very well, but whereabouts do you think this is heading come the autumn?
Well, I think that we're now committing the resources of the state, both in the US and Britain, to propping up the private banking system. And for a time being, that has caused the stock markets to rally a little. Because, of course, if you're going to be given endless free money by the government, then that would make you rally a bit. But the problem is going to be hitting sterling and the dollar eventually, because neither Britain nor the United States can afford to prop up the bankrupt banking system. And that will become apparent before the end of the year.
So if you had the ear of Mr. Darling, what would you be advising him to do now?
I think it's very difficult for him to do anything, because he's been so associated. He and Mr. Brown have been very associated with this pro-bank policy over the last decade. What they really needed to do was to get a grip on the situation and, as the Liberal Democrats have been saying, to nationalise the banks. And in fact, nationalising the banks doesn't cost lots of money, because what you do is you let them go bust and then you turn around and say, right, we're taking you over, not for money, but for nothing. Now, what we've been doing is chucking money at them so that they can carry on calling themselves private banks. But that is just ideology gone mad.
It does seem that there's going to be a lot of demands on public spending, but it's almost like the banks have got there beforehand.
That's quite right. And I think that's what will become increasingly apparent, is that the money that should be used to reflate the economy, you're right, you should go into debt in a recession to reflate the economy, but you should spend the money on the real economy, not on the financial economy, which is already bust. But the banks have managed to even spin this last, that they had too much power to begin with, and they've still got too much power. They are calling the shots, and that is completely wrong. They are bankrupt. They shouldn't be calling the shots. they should be being told what they're going to do.
So why haven't the government done this then? It seems that, you know, if they're acting in our interest, that's what they should be doing, maybe.
Well, what you've got to understand in Britain, the US and elsewhere is there is the electoral process, which elects governments. And then, of course, all politicians require money in order to get elected. So they're under two sets of pressures. They're under pressure from the electorate to deliver on things like health and education and so on. They're under pressure from the markets and the private banks to deliver on what their agenda is. And all politicians of any political party have to make some kind of arrangement between those two forces. Whoever wins the next election in this country will face that choice. Unfortunately, as I stressed earlier, the banks have had far too much power and still have far too much power.
Right, thanks, Martin. And next week you'll be back and we'll be discussing the housing situation. So I look forward to that. That was Martin Summers, who is our economics and maybe next week also housing correspondent. Thanks, Martin. Now, since the Second World War, the government and local authorities have had responsibility to look after the population in time of war or other emergency. But the way they do that changed in 2000 with the introduction of the Civil Contingencies Act. Gone is the emphasis on protecting the population through a series of nuclear bunkers. Now, rather than simply enforcing the law, the police are in the driving seat. On the 3rd of April, US President Barack Obama said at the NATO conference in Strasbourg that, and I quote, "It's probably more likely that Al-Qaeda would be able to launch a serious terrorist attack in Europe than in the United States because of proximity." But what do you think? Could Bristol be a target of a terrorist attack? Our reporter Quentin Marceron went out onto the streets of Bristol city centre to find out what we Bristolians think about the terror threat in our city. Is it real? And if so, who might be behind it?
But I would say more chance in London. Yeah, London.
I mean, I suppose they have the airport, but the airport's not in the centre, is it?
Yeah.
So maybe I'd be more concerned, maybe.
I never think of Bristol being under threat of terrorist attack now.
Why not?
I don't know. I always think that people would go to London if they were going to attack anywhere, because it's the centre of, like, I don't know, financially.
Do you think it would be more symbolic in London?
Yeah, I suppose so, and because you've got like the big landmarks and you've got the politicians and everyone's there. So,
I suppose with buildings like the train station, there's always a potential risk, I guess. Well, I mean, I suppose that if terrorists wanted to disrupt the way of life, I suppose the transport networks would be one way of doing this. So if they could take out the bridge, or the bridges, bus station, or the train station, then, well, they would disrupt our way of life. Well, I suppose, okay, the most obvious one in the media would be the Islamic threat. That's, it could be from anyone, really. Anyone who has a grudge against a particular culture, a particular way of life.
Possibly. Well, there's a big young Muslim population here that I've seen are angry. But what would they attack? You know, this is... Maybe it's not big enough for them to make an impact. Okay. I think more so than domestic terrorists, yes. It has a high population. Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I think London would primarily be the target of attacks, but not.
Why?
Well, because I've lived here for a few months now, and nothing has happened like as much as in London.
Wolfram, maybe.
Actually, I don't know enough about this to say, but I don't think for now there's going to be any terrorist attacks in London. But I'm just saying it's more likely than. You know, that happening in London than in Bristol, that's all.
I wouldn't have thought so. I don't come across it much often. Okay, well, I was down at the G20 protest kind of last Saturday, just gone, down in London, what with the summit like happening on Wednesday and Thursday last week. And if anywhere, I would have thought London should have been on red alert. But as for Bristol, no, I'm quite... I don't think so. Well,
why not?
Don't know, bunch of hippies. I don't know. No, just generally, I wouldn't have thought it was on the map. We're not a main port. It's kind of, there's no exports that leave here. We've got a lot of certainly young people that have come here and seen quite a lot, you know, externally outside their own countries that have come here seeking asylum and been granted refugee status. And there's certainly a very, very small amount. It would be in-house. I don't believe it would be external. It would be someone here who's very familiar with the surroundings and someone possibly, you know, your neighbour in terms of you chat to every morning. And that's not, I'm not saying that that's for us to be paranoid.
Anywhere is, any city today, any
why?
Target. Well, that's just the way things are, isn't it? They haven't ruled out attacking any city. It's densely populated, you know, you've got an awful lot of people in shopping centres every day and especially at weekend.
And who from would it be?
Well, the usual suspects, isn't it? Al-Qaeda, or I suppose it is Al-Qaeda mainly that we hear of, don't know. We call them terrorists, they call themselves freedom fighters. Even the stop clock's right twice a day. I suppose they've got a case, but they're going about it the wrong way, aren't they?
I wouldn't have said so, no. I mean, it's a busy city, you know, it's one of the biggest in the UK, but I wouldn't have said it's under threat from terrorists.
Why not?
I don't know. I mean, obviously London is the major one, but there doesn't seem to be anything in Bristol, other than the docks maybe, that would possibly be a target for terrorists. Yeah, so.
And if there was, who from would it be, do you think?
I've got no idea anymore. You know, it used to be just Al-Qaeda, the main ones obviously, and whatever, but I don't know, there's so many minor organisations now that, you know, it could be from anybody, I don't know anymore.
So that was Quentin Masseron out on the streets of Bristol, discovering some of your thoughts and feelings on the likelihood or otherwise of a terror attack on Bristol. People tend to think that if we do have terrorist attacks in the UK, it's more likely to happen in London, because it would be more symbolic and significant, and Bristol, thankfully, doesn't seem to be a strategical city for this type of action. Now, whilst tensions mount around the world and Britain is actually at war with Afghanistan, is the President emergency planning regime up to the job? Kelvin Hattersley manages Bristol's Emergency Planning Department.
I'm Kelvin Hattersley, Civil Protection Manager for Bristol City Council.
So you're the guy who's in charge if things go wrong. What sort of contingencies are there in the city if we get some sort of disaster, whether it be an emergency of some kind, whether it be natural or some kind of terrorist type or war type situation?
First, you just made clear I won't be in charge, but I'll be there supporting. The Civil Contingencies Act places a duty on the local authority to work with its partner agencies to ensure that we're in a position to respond to any emergency. An emergency is defined as anything that can impact on human welfare, so it could be anything from a flood, severe weather, breakdown of transport or food or anything like that. And so it's ensuring that we try to maintain some degree of normality. And so we work with our partner agencies to ensure that we've got the ability to be able to respond to any emergency that might affect the community or even ourselves.
So who are your partner agencies, and if you're not in charge, who is?
Well, the partner agencies are defined as Category 1 or 2 responders within the Act. Category 1 responders are the police, the fire, the ambulance, elements of the health, so it's acute trust, the primary care trust, Maritime Coast Guard Agency, the Environment Agency, local authorities. We are defined as Category 1 responders, and we have specific duties to work together to plan for anything that that might happen, and I can give you some examples.
Okay, so yeah, the second part of the question was, you're the manager, but who's actually in charge if there is an emergency?
Yeah. It's actually a shared responsibility. The police will normally coordinate the response. The way it's done is usually through a structured approach. We have three levels of management: strategic, tactical and operational. It normally starts off at the operational end, an emergency, shall we use the normal set of circumstances, a fire, 999 call is made, fire brigade attend, might require ambulance, might require police, and then quite clearly from that it might escalate because roads have got to be closed, so the local authority then becomes involved because we have to help cordon off roads and redirect traffic to support the emergency services. Buildings themselves could be then affected in such a way that the fire brigade and the police would wish to investigate it as a crime scene. Now, if the building's been affected by the fire, they may then come to the local authority and ask for some of our building control officers to inspect the premises to ensure they're safe before the investigative officers go inside. So the local authority could get involved that way. The people who were affected at the premises may themselves now be made homeless, so the local authority has a duty to look after people who've been made temporarily homeless because of emergencies. So the police normally coordinate that response, and the responding agencies will send the appropriate liaison officers and response officers to the scene. If the incident is of a significant geographical area, or it's covering larger numbers of people, then the police might decide then to bring in what's called the tactical role. And that means we operate with a number of senior managers then getting together at this tactical role. It's colour-coded. That's now called the silver control. Usually at a police station, it might be at a church hall. It depends on the circumstances. And there'll be a senior representative from all the appropriate agencies there looking at how they can then support those who are delivering the response. If it gets any bigger than that, then we have gold control or the strategic, which would open at police headquarters. And a good example was the flooding in Gloucestershire in 2007, and your listeners will probably remember seeing the chief constable chairing gold and looking at the strategic issues. So we've got exactly the same plans in this location, coordinated by the police, and our representatives at the appropriate levels will be at those three positions if it was to escalate that big.
But that's all very well for a situation like flooding or natural disaster, but with something a bit more sort of political, like rioting, that kind of thing, do you think is it still the same sort of situation where the police are really running it? Because one would have hoped that there'd be some kind of city councillors would be involved and some of the politicians would be involved in the response.
Well, clearly there's two aspects to that question. One is, first of all, if you're talking about rioting, and clearly that's a public order issue, which is in the hands of the police. But in any set of circumstances, the operational aspect is always dealt by operational officers at the scene or in a management role. Clearly, from a council's perspective, yes, elected members would have an involvement. They would be appropriately briefed. But the actual decision-making at the scene is very much down to the officers.
We've been talking to people in the city centre, asking them what they think may be the sorts of emergencies, or whether they think Bristol is a likely target for terrorists. There's several scenarios that have come up through that. One of them is an attack on Avonmouth or Hinckley Power Station. Obviously, we've got westerly winds here, so any kind of attack down or upwind of Bristol, we would find a sort of cloud of nasty, noxious substances heading towards the city. Are you prepared for that?
The generic emergency planning that we do covers a lot of issues. Now, you mentioned Avonmouth. We've got a number of chemical sites down there. They're covered by fairly stringent regulations in consequence of previous incidents that have occurred down there back in the 80s. We actually have a warning system down there, the Seven Side Sirens. I say we, it's actually run by a charitable trust called the Seven Side Sirens Trust. But we're partners to that, and I say we, that's the authority, with other authorities and the chemical sites. We deliver over 15,000 booklets to residents and businesses in the area, and if the sirens are sounded, the advice is go in, stay in and tune in, listen to the radio. The issue of Hinckley clearly is something that lies in Somerset County Council's domain. It's not within mine. They have emergency plans for that, and I can't speak any more in relation to those issues. But clearly, one of the duties that we all have, not just Bristol City Council, but all the Category 1 responders, is a duty to warn and inform the public. Now, part of that warning and informing, first of all, is education, making people aware. And I gave you the example then of booklets going out into the Seven Side area. So many people now are aware of the sirens down there. They know that when the sirens go off, that they should close their windows, go indoors, listen to the radio, and wait for further advice. And it's very similar to any other emergency. Immediately, the media will want some information, and clearly what we would do in a partnership way with our colleagues in the other services is to ensure that information is got out to the public appropriate to the emergency that's happened and the sort of measures they would need to take.
Yes, but I mean, surely it's not really good enough for you to say, oh, well, Hinckley is Somerset's responsibility because, you know, if there's some sort of radioactive cloud heading this way, it's not going to respect county boundaries.
I fully accept what you're saying about that, but the issue is very much the same. If there was an incident down there, then public information would be issued. There is already a public information warning situation in the Hinckley area. As far as this locality is concerned, we would receive information from there because it's within the same police force area, and radio channels would be notified, and appropriate broadcasts would be put out to warn and inform the public.
How seriously do you take the threat of possible terrorist attack then?
Yeah, terrorism, we're aware where there have been incidents in the country, and it's one of the issues we work with our partners to ensure that if something of that nature takes place, we're in a position to be able to respond to support, because quite clearly terrorism is a criminal issue, so very much in the police hands.
Okay, but do you think that the city is prepared if in case there is an attack in the city? I mean, we're told all the time that the threat of terrorism is great. It doesn't actually seem as if we've even got, probably at the moment, as many terrorist incidents as there were back in the bad old days of the IRA. But are you prepared?
I would say we're as prepared as we can be. One of the things we have been doing with businesses is actually working with the police and local businesses to ensure they are much more aware of their responsibilities. We've actually taken them through a number of scenarios in order that they are better placed to be able to look after their own staff and their own visitors. So we've done a lot of work in the background to ensure that as much planning can be done to improve resilience within the city centre.
Now, the whole business of this civil resilience is comes under the auspices of something called the Civil Contingencies Act 2004. Previously to that, it was the Civil Defence Act. Can you tell us what roughly the difference has been? You know, many people won't have noticed this new act creeping in. So what's changed since around about the year 2000?
Well, the Civil Defence Act was, as it almost implies, was about defending this country. It was very old legislation going back to 1948. The year 2000 was a bit of a watershed in as much there was recognition that we had lots of other types of emergencies, not necessarily military conflict, that we had to ensure that the country was prepared for. And so that's why government introduced the Civil Contingencies Act, and that's why the definition of an emergency is a very broad one, which covers anything that can impact on human nature, human welfare, impact on the environment, and then eventually it also looks at war and terrorism. But the important issues, when one looks back over the last 10 years, it's very much been surrounding the preparedness for natural emergencies such as bad weather, flooding, or the sorts of incidents such as the Bunsfield explosion, where you've got an extraordinary incident which creates significant damage, impacts society, and then how we all work together to bring back a degree of normality.
Now, the criticism of that has been many, many different types of reasons that that the government can institute these emergency powers, and that then means that the country is effectively being run by decree, just by the cabinet, without legislation going through parliament. I mean, isn't that actually quite a dangerous situation, and it could inflame the population?
No, I'm not prepared to answer that question, because this is very much a political issue. The safeguards are built in there when the bill was being prepared, and this is very much a question which should be directed at politicians. I'm not in a position to answer that.
That was Kelvin Hattersley bleeping away in the background. Then I asked Bristol City Council's Emergency Planning Chief, Kelvin, and about his department's preparedness for the BBC Survivors series scenario, that is, disease. Just finding that now, particular piece.
One of the top priorities in the country is being prepared for pandemic flu, which is a real concern with the Department of Health. We, when I say we, that's the joint agencies, have just published our pandemic flu plan, which the public can access off of the Avenus Somerset Constabulary website. In fact, we've now also established the link off the Bristol City Council website, so they can go and actually see the pandemic flu plan, the strategic one, which looks at how the joint authorities will respond to pandemic flu if it were ever to happen in the UK. And likewise, here in the council, we've got our own internal one, which is looking at how the council will continue to look at delivering its essential businesses to protect the vulnerable in the city.
how that response actually take place, because obviously there's just not enough facilities in the city to cope. I mean, you know, how would the health service and I imagine the ambulance service and people like that cope in a situation like that?
Well, this is all part of what's called business continuity planning. Each one of us has had to look at where our critical areas of work are and to ensure that we have the ability to maintain those critical areas. And this is what we've done within the council. We've identified the critical services which, if it means that other services may have to stop to maintain those critical services, that's what will happen. That'll be a management decision dependent on the circumstances. But the important thing is that we will continue to deliver what is essential to the city.
Now, one of the characteristics of any emergency is that people often panic. What can you say to calm people's nerves if something like this does happen in the city, well, whatever, whichever one of these categories, natural or terrorism or war, what can you say to reassure them?
Well, I think, first of all, it's about being prepared. You're listening to me talk to say we are preparing the council to respond. I think now it's all about the community being prepared and being resilient themselves. It's one of the reasons why in the council's Our City magazine, which went out recently, we raised some of the issues with the public about how you can prepare yourselves, because it's quite evident that in a significant incident of whatever sort, our concern is going to be about looking after those who are the most vulnerable. Many people can actually look after themselves. We do it on a day-to-day basis. We ensure we cross the road safely. We ensure we lock our house up when we go on holiday. And all we're asking the community to do is think about some resilience planning. So if they had to suddenly leave their home, what would they take with them? If they had to stay in their home for a period of time, because as you indicated earlier on, there was something in the atmosphere from one of our chemical sites for a brief period, how would they respond to that? And it's not about panicking, it's actually being sensible and actually thinking about how you as a family would respond, and then also listening to information coming from the Category 1 responders, which will be giving further advice of things they could do.
One of the things that people didn't come up with when we asked them, but which I'm quite curious to know about, is this current financial situation. And we're in a situation where people may find that economically that the money system isn't working as it should be. Is that something that comes into your remit or not? I mean, if people are actually finding that they haven't got the money to buy food and things like that, then there could, you know, obviously be a crisis resulting from that. Does that actually come in your remit, or is that just pie in the sky right now?
No, that certainly doesn't come within my remit. I mean, clearly we are aware of the economic downturn and the impact it's having locally on businesses. But insofar as individuals are concerned, clearly those who are vulnerable have the means of obtaining through the appropriate agencies the support they can get. But it's not something that I particularly are looking at.
Okay, so where do people go to find out more about what you do? I imagine you've got websites and leaflets and things like that. Where's a good place if people are concerned about this and want to find out more? Where can they find out more?
Okay, simply going to the council's website, bristol.gov.uk, /emergencies, and there they'll have links to pages which will give them a whole series of advice from a local perspective. If they wish to look at it more nationally, there's two other websites. One is the government one, which is ukresilience.gov.uk. And there is another one, Preparing for Emergencies, which is a national one, which we have links to from our website. But all three will give very generic information. But certainly I would recommend your listeners to go to our own website, where we've got details about even preparing your own family emergency plan and thinking those issues through. It's all about being prepared. It's about being resilient. But it's not about panicking, it's actually just taking some natural steps to ensure that in the event of something happening, you're better prepared and better able to deal with it.
One of the problems, if there is an emergency, is that some of the communications may be down, so people might not be able to go on the internet and find these websites.
Well, at the time of an emergency, I fully agree, communications will be an issue, so that's why we're saying do it in advance, whilst everything's in operation. You've got your own paper copies at home. Think about your own communication plans within your own family, because we acknowledge that we rely on technology an awful lot now, But think about that if communications were to go down in this area, but you wanted to talk to your family, well, there may be other ways of actually using a relative living in another part of the country as being the conduit for information. So it's just thinking outside the box and being prepared.
And what about the leaflets? Where can people get hold of those?
Well, we've got leaflets that can be downloaded off the website, but in the very near future we'll be putting leaflets and some bookmarks out into libraries and our customer service points, which will give them further advice.
Anyway, that was Kelvin Hattersley, Emergency Planning Manager for Bristol City Council. Now, I thought it would be interesting to get the perspective of one of the old-style civil defence people. Peter Hamilton Harvey trained to be a civil defence officer down in Bournemouth back in the 1980s, before the Civil Contingencies Bill came into force.
My name's Peter Hamilton Harvey. I was born in Bournemouth, and I've been the Vice President of the Ratepayers and Residents Association in Merrick Park for quite a number of years, and I think it was under that jurisdiction that I was invited to become a team leader of what used to be civil defence, which is now called civil protection.
So what did you do as part of your training?
Part of my training? We went on outbacking and pioneering and learning how to survive. And
How long did it take for you to be trained up?
Fully trained over a period of several years. Quite an intense course, partly an army course, partly military. Learning everything about survival and how to survive, learning about chemical warfare, all the horrible things that you hear about on television, terrorism and all that type of thing.
So how does a town cope with some sort of emergency? Take us through it.
Yes. Basically, there's a network that's set up, which will only come into operation if there is any form of civil emergency. That's flooding, fire, terrorism, warfare, anything. There are people out there who are like sleeping policemen in some respects, or sleeping soldiers. And our job is to keep up with what's happening, what's going on, keep up with technology, and then come into play as and when we're required if emergency exists.
So in any town and city in Britain, well, city certainly in Britain, has its own sort of network of civil defence bunkers still. Whereabouts in an ordinary city can we expect to see these?
All the bunkers have to be in a strategic place so that members of the population can be directed to them at virtually 5 to 10 minutes notice. The original object of civil defence was to rescue and save as many people as possible in the event of a war, provide for them and be able to cope within reasonably a 6 to 8 month period in a bunker. So people, if they had to live underground for 6 to 8 months, would be fully looked after.
So obviously we've got most city halls, town halls in the larger cities and towns will have a bunker underneath them. Whereabouts else might there be bunkers?
Yeah, the town hall system is interesting because obviously in any form of emergency there has to be a head of operations and a communication system set up. So every town hall is provided with an emergency bunker or room, communications room, which will run the system. From then on you've got all the services like the fire brigade, ambulance, hospitals, everything else, who are the second and third lines of defence as such. And then people are allocated to operate bunkers and communication rooms from the different bunkers within the cities and towns.
Now, your training was really related to Bournemouth and the defence of Bournemouth in an emergency, and we've just had a look at two bunkers. One is right next to the Bath Hotel, which is obviously to look after the VIP guests that are in that hotel. The other one I think is more interesting. That's underneath a big multi-storey car park. What was the purpose of that one?
That was a strategic location which would hold the maximum number of people. I mean, it sleeps probably about 500 or more people. It was placed there because of the density of the population within that area, and it's a strategic place to get to.
How has the thinking and priorities of civil defence changed, do you think, since you did your training back in the 80s? And in fact, it's kind of disappeared off the radar, hasn't it?
It has. It had a high-profile status to start with. It had a very bit large office. Anybody could go and find it. Anybody could look it up in a phone book or anything like that. These days it's disappeared completely. During my training, When we began the training, the object was to rescue everybody. Towards the end of the training, it was really looking at an elite bunch of people that would be saved. That was quite a horrific change due to costs and economics. And today it's now an elite society.
You mean the sort of emergency planning people?
The emergency planning people and those in the know. The general public are not really aware of what to do or have any concept of what to do in an emergency.
So if there is an emergency, who will be running things?
Only those people who are trained.
So who are they generally? Are we talking about council officers, Lord Lieutenant, town clerk, who?
They are the elite and the chosen few, and they can be councillors and town... Well, sometimes they're not councillors. They're civil servants and people appointed to do a particular job.
OK, so what would you say if we are faced with an emergency? What should Joe Public do to survive? Is there anything?
Find out someone in a strategic position, like the fire chief or the ambulance chief, and hang around them because they know exactly what they're going to do.
What about the involvement of councillors, you know, the people we elect to run our city?
The majority of local councillors are lay people. They really are not involved at the top, and therefore they are like any other citizen. Unless they find out how the system works, they've no idea, not a clue at all. Community or civil protection is the current title of the operation. And there is in every town hall and every county council and district council and city council a community protection or officer.
Well, that was Peter Hamilton Harvey from a wealthy Bournemouth family with his own rather different view of civil protection. As well as all council offices, as Kelvin mentioned, you can get leaflets from here at the BCFM reception, Russelltown Avenue off Church Road in Barton Hill. Now, our continental correspondent, Quentin Marceron.
Hi, Bristol. Hi, Tony. I'm going to talk to you about France in NATO. So NATO is a military alliance established by the signing of the North Atlantic Treaty on the 4th of April 1949. Founders included the United States, the United Kingdom, France and Italy. Originally, the organization's goal was a defensive alliance in Europe against a possible Soviet invasion after the Second World War. In 1966, former French President Charles de Gaulle decided to withdraw from NATO's military command because he was unhappy with the United States' leading role in the organization and what he perceived as a special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom. Last month, after 43 years of this interruption, France came back to full membership in the organization. This announcement from French President Nicolas Sarkozy caused a lot of reactions in France. Let's hear a document on Radio France International.
France is one of NATO's most active members, sending the first European troops into Kosovo, participating in the stabilization of Bosnia, and providing one of the largest national contingents to the international force in Afghanistan. If this is the case, then why has France's move proved so controversial? Well, it stems from Charles de Gaulle's decision to pull France out of the integrated military command of NATO in 1966, in protest of U.S. domination. Alain Richard was France's defense minister from 1997 to 2002. He says that keeping close allies in NATO, but a free hand to act independently on the world stage, was the hallmark of the Gaullist tradition in French foreign policy, and this still resonates today.
Over time, the ridiculous stance of France within the alliance was used as a diplomatic, as a sort of passport to appear as a non-entirely Western country, a global power able to deal with non-Western countries in slightly different terms from the rest of the West. It's being a member of the alliance with its basic loyalty, but a more independent handling of its own military, and for most of the politicians now in France, it's this aspect which is at stake.
Because of this long history of adamant foreign policy independence, Sarkozy's plan has drawn lots of criticism. Jean-Marc Ayrault is the socialist group leader in the National Assembly. He says that France's voice will be drowned out of the international debate.
Nous nous sommes tout à fait opposés au retour de la France dans le commandement intégré de l'OTAN.
We are totally opposed to the integration of France into NATO. There's no need for it. Contrary to what the government says, it's not a simple formality. I think that we have to keep our strategic decision-making autonomy. France isn't as powerful as the US. But by being outside of NATO's integrated command, we have kept our freedom of expression. Here we are going to be drowned out, and what we say just won't matter anymore.
Vis-à-vis des autres pays, et nous ne pèserons plus.
There's irony behind this opposition, says Jean-Pierre Molny of the think tank IRIS, because the integration won't change a thing for France. It's all just semantics.
What is funny in certain things is that it doesn't change nothing about the decision and the vote, because we are at the NAC, when there are the meeting with the ambassador, when the decision are taken. In the past, we vote. The only thing that it will change is the question of the planning of the military operation. If we are in the military command structure, we can have more input for the preparation of the planning of the military operation.
But of course, France will be keeping a last foothold outside of NATO. It's not integrating into the alliance's nuclear group, which means that it will keep its famous independent nuclear deterrent. So at least one last vestige of Gaullism will live on in French foreign policy.
That was Marco Schoen-Overd reporting on Radio France International. For the Socialist Party, opposed to Sarkozy's government, this return will weaken France's international relations policies. Generally, it's on one hand viewed as a loss of independence with the end of this particular opposition, and on the other hand as a real good strategy because France is going to go back to the Commission, which determines NATO military objectives.
Okay, Quentin, thanks very much for that. Now it's time to hand over to Colin Power, who, as a layman in Bristol, has been doing a practical exploration of the British court system.
Good afternoon, Bristol. It's Colin Power here with a quick news broadcast segment. What we've been, I'll just explain a little bit about myself. Firstly, I'm not legally trained, so I've just been digging around and putting my nose where I shouldn't, maybe, and just trying to find out what's going on with this country today. Now, many people might be concerned about the number of laws that there seem to be popping up all over the place recently. There's been a fair few laws coming out of the government recently, and in fact, for the last few years. But the actual thing is that many people aren't actually aware of the legal and factual difference between a statute and a law. Now, I've been sort of doing a little bit of digging. I actually bought myself a copy of Black's Law, 8th edition, and I looked up lawful in there, and the definition is, it says there, not contrary to law. So that means basically something that is not going against law. Now, if you look up the definition of legal, however, it is defined as of or relating to law. Now, of or relating to law means that basically it is not law all-encompassing. In fact, I would say there's a number of different types of law, of which statute law is only one of them. For example, admiralty law, civil law, commercial law, common law, criminal law, illustratical law, general law, international law, moral law, natural law, private law, political law, positive law, procedural law, public law, and special law. So if you know what all those laws mean, then maybe you know more than I. But just to point out that statute law may not be everything that it's cracked up to be. So I think what we're going to do is we're going to play a quick song by one of my favourites, by a guy called Paul Simon, and then we're going to make a quick telephone call to see if we can find out why all these laws are really coming into effect in England today.
Mama pajama rolled out of bed and she ran to the police station. When the papa found out, he began to shout and he started the investigation. It's against the law. It was against the law. Oh, what did mama saw? It was against the law. When the mama looked down and spit on the ground every time my name gets mentioned. The papa said, oh, if I get that boy, I'm gonna stick him in the house of detention. Well, I'm on my way. I don't know where I'm going. I'm on my way. I'm taking my time, but I don't know where. Goodbye to Rose, the queen of Corona. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard.
Okay, so let's see if we can call up the man now. Let's see if we've got the phone ringing there. Oh, no. Seems like the phone's gone dead all of a sudden. Right, okay, well, we've lost contact with our man. So I'll tell you what we'll do. Let's just see if we can... Oh, I think we're back on. Are we back on there? Oh, no, we're not. We've lost our phone conversation now. That's a bit of a shame. Never mind. Well, basically, seem to be buzzing, and that's it. Okay, well,
See you, me and Julio down by the schoolyard.
Okay, so maybe we could just maybe have a quick look at some of the things that, as I sort of anyone could do, they could just look on the internet and find some of this information out. Now, basically, it would appear that corporations have been taking over the world, as some may be aware. If you go to a website called Dun & Bradstreet, you can actually look at all the corporations and companies that exist throughout the world, basically. Now, if you were to, say, type in something like, say, I don't know, Bristol Magistrates Court or something like that, they would actually pop up on Dun & Bradstreet as a for-profit corporation trading out of Bristol. Now, that would be on the international markets that they would be trading. So that's quite an interesting thing that sort of got me looking into some of this stuff. Furthermore, I also found United Kingdom Limited and United Kingdom Corporation Limited. Those seem to be quite interesting corporations that were making money and trading on the international stock markets again. We've also found here a corporation called Southwest One has been reported to us. And I looked into the... looked into this corporation, and it found out that it's actually a corporation which is a joint venture company set up by Somerset Council, Taunton Deane Council, and now including Avon and Somerset Police. So there's another corporation there that's trading money on the international stock markets in order to raise financial capital. But the thing is, what I wanted to know is, what are they actually trading? Well, I did a little bit more looking into that, and it turns out that, for example, when the corporation members of Parliament, also trading as House of Commons, raise a bill, shall we say, that's what it's actually called, that bill then gets traded on the international stock market, and money is associated to it, and an international bank may well buy that bill out. And then, obviously, once they purchase the revenue stream to that bill, then they'll be required to be paid back, should any miscreants be... prosecuted for such a law. So there you go. So that might be one of the reasons why the government is passing so many of these laws at the moment, because I think there's a real need for us to make a bit more money. So don't be good, be naughty, and let's raise a bit more money for the government and help them out financially, and hopefully we can all get this country back on its feet. Brilliant. Okay, my name's Colin Powell. Once again, I'd just like to say I'm not legally trained. It's just some information I've just come across and just looking over. And I hope that you will too. If you do get a chance, do check out some of the links, like the Anti-Terrorist YouTube broadcast. Very well recommended stuff there, which would get you started, and some of the places you could look to check some of this information out. That's all for me this week, and hopefully again next week, we'll be discussing a little bit more of this law business, which, you know, we're not quite sure, obviously, how it all works yet. But if you have any ideas, maybe you could contact me and let me know. See you then. Take care. Bye.
First of all, Colin, how do we contact you?
Oh, you could just send me an email. Sorry, colin@911truthbristol.com.
Okay, well, that's lovely. Thanks very much. Now we're going to have a little bit of music from Vaya con Dios.
What's the word? She'll be weak, she'll be strong. Struggle on for so long. When right turns to wrong, she will try to hold on to the ghost of the past. When love was to last, dreams from the past faded so fast. All alone in the dark, she will swear he'll never mislead her again.
Con Dios there. Well, the hour of six is approaching, and that's all we have time for this week. Join us on Friday Drive Time, this and every Friday, 5 till 6 for the next month here on BCFM. We'll be keeping a pace of the latest developments in Bristol, Britain and around the world. At least we'll be trying to. Next week, we take an in-depth look at Bristol's housing. As the financial disaster kicks in, how will we make sure we've got a secure roof over our heads? We'll be taking a look at how some groups in the city are preparing for the effects of the slump on some of the poorest and most indebted in society. So thanks to our reporter, Quentin Masseron. The Legal Minefield reporter was Colin Power. Economic analysis and review of this week's stories was by Martin Summers. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing weekend. And remember, we have 60 million people in Britain and roughly 60 million acres. So whilst it might feel sometimes there's not enough resources to go round, that's only because corporations and the super rich have more than their share. All we have to do is make sure that 60 million acres is shared out, and with modern technology we can all live together quite happily. Most importantly, don't let the bankers get you down. Join us next week for Friday Drive Time.
Are listening on BCFM.